Wayfair's Labor Day clearance is here. Right now, score up to 70% off everything home, plus fast shipping on everything right to your door. Shop now through September 2nd at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hey everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key of the Case. Welcome back. Thank you all for tuning in to Key of the Case this week. And we also want to extend a special thank you to our listener, Kaylee, for suggesting today's case. We recently realized that we completely glossed over our 2-year podcast anniversary, which was about a month ago when this episode is coming out. Not that there's anything super specific about it that we wanted to say. It's just exciting that we made it this far, because when we started, we didn't know how long we would be doing the podcast. We still don't know, but we certainly wouldn't be doing it anymore if we didn't have all of you listening. I also think it's really cool that some people have been with us since the very beginning and have stuck with us this entire time, or that some people just found us a few weeks ago and listened through our entire backlog.
Yeah, it's been a great 2 years plus. And honestly, I feel like we're just getting started.
Yeah, it's weird because it's kind of hard to remember a time when we didn't have the podcast. But in other ways, yeah, it feels like we just got started. Before we get into the case, I will warn you that we will be discussing the disappearance of 2 children. So please listen with care. All right, let's dive in. Scott Fandel was 13 at the time of his disappearance, and Amy Fandel was 8 at the time of her disappearance in 1978. Scott and Amy lived with their mom, Margaret, in a secluded log cabin in Sterling, Alaska. Sterling is a small community nestled along the Kenai River on the Kenai Peninsula, known for amazing salmon fishing and beautiful surroundings. It's the kind of place where people enjoy the quiet, spend time outdoors, and live sort of off the beaten path. Now, I said Scott and Amy lived with their mom. They had previously lived with both of their parents in the same home, but their mom and dad, Margaret and Roger, separated 8 to 9 months before the kids disappeared. Margaret and Roger had a rocky marriage, and Roger especially has been very vocal about how he wanted out of that marriage. And not that Margaret wanted to be in the marriage either. She didn't. She just hasn't been as vocal about that part of her life. Roger admitted that he was not a good spouse to Margaret, but loved his children. Roger was not Scott's biological father. He came into the picture when Scott was very young and took on a parental role since Scott's biological father was not in his life. Margaret and Roger then had a child together, Amy, a few years after they married. Scott and Amy were close with both of their parents, so when Roger met a new woman and left Margaret, as well as the kids, that affected the children and Margaret deeply. Roger found a job as a steam fitter in Arizona, so he and the woman he began seeing packed up and moved to Arizona. He promised the kids that he would come back for them, and Scott even told his friends this, but he did not come back before they disappeared. Margaret worked as a waitress at a local restaurant, and when Roger left, she began working longer and more frequent shifts, often leaving the kids home alone. As a single parent to 2 young children, she was feeling an immense amount of stress and pressure. She was working 7 days a week to feed the kids and keep the lights on. There was not a lot left over. They were truly living paycheck to paycheck. Because of this, Scott, who was only 13, took on a lot of responsibilities that other kids his age were not concerned with, such as looking after his younger sister, taking care of the house, and cooking. Through my research, I saw that Scott was described as mature several times. I imagine there was some natural maturity there, but the circumstances could have accelerated his maturity as well. To make matters worse, Margaret was plagued with loneliness. And this, along with the stress she was experiencing, seemed to cause her to turn to alcohol, and she began spending more time drinking than she previously had. Margaret spent many nights out at bars while the kids looked after themselves at home. Scott scolded his mom for this, and he was simply unimpressed with some of the men she dated in the months before he and Amy disappeared. Despite the troubles at home, Scott and Amy were described as happy and full of life. Scott was funny and intelligent, and one article referred to him as a witty little man. And his intelligence was something many people spoke of. It came up quite often. Now, he didn't always have straight A's, but that could be related to his irregular attendance. Teachers of both Scott and Amy indicated that they had poor records of attendance, which I presume is related to their home life. Scott enjoyed fishing and riding his dirt bike. He never walked if he could ride his bike. Amy was characterized as a bright, sweet, and gentle girl who got along well with everyone. By early September 1978, Scott, Amy, and Margaret had something to look forward to. Margaret's younger sister, Kathy, was moving to Alaska to live with them. On September 5th, Scott turned in a write-up for one of his classes. The Anchorage Daily News reported that he wrote, quote, "Dear Journal, today at 3:30, an aunt of mine is coming up to live with us. She's never been to Alaska. Matter of fact, she's never been out of Illinois, where she lives. She's going to have a birthday tomorrow. She'll be 20. Kathy is her name. She's going to live with us for the rest of her life. What else can I say? She is going to work with my mom at the Italian Gardens restaurant," end quote. Kathy was quite a bit younger than Margaret. Kathy was, like he said, just about to turn 20, and Margaret was 31 at this time. The plan was that Kathy would move to Sterling to work at the same restaurant as Margaret, and together they hoped to earn enough money to move the family to Illinois, where Margaret and Kathy were from. So Kathy was essentially just there to help her sister. She must have been at a point in her life where she could pick up and move to Alaska temporarily. But I'm sure Margaret was looking forward to having help with the kids and working toward that collective goal of moving the family back to Illinois. That very day when she arrived was the same day the kids disappeared. September 5th, 1978 started as an ordinary day. Scott and Amy's teachers would later recount that they behaved normally during the school day, and after school, Margaret, Scott, and Amy headed to the airport to pick Kathy up. After picking her up, some sources indicated they gave Kathy a tour of Sterling to help her get acquainted with the area. They then shared dinner at the cabin and headed out to Good Time Charlie's in Soldotna, which is 10 to 15 minutes from their home. What's interesting here is that all sources I found refer to Good Time Charlie's as a bar that featured video games, pool, and foosball, so kind of an arcade area. However, when you look up Good Time Charlie's, it was most definitely a strip club. And I say was because it shut down a few years ago. It was a pretty long-standing business. So, of course, there's a lot of chatter online about why in the world Margaret would bring her children to a strip club. I thought that was bizarre as well, so I did some digging, and a man named Charlie Cunningham purchased this business in 1972, 6 years before this case. It was previously called Hilltop Bar and Cafe. When Charlie took over the bar, he renamed it after himself as Good Time Charlie's and branded it as a rock music bar. It later transitioned to a country and western music bar, then disco, and finally it became a strip club. It clearly went through multiple phases. So to my knowledge, it was not a strip club in 1978. The first record I could find of it being one was 1981. If someone has information indicating otherwise, you can let us know. But I wanted to make that distinction. You might still think she shouldn't have had her kids out at a bar on a school night, and that's fair. But it is different from a strip club that advertised bottomless and topless dancing. Margaret and Kathy drank beer and socialized with the other patrons while the kids sipped on soda.
Yeah, she was probably just taking them out on a school night since it was kind of a special occasion. You know, her younger sister's in town to stay with them for the foreseeable future. So yeah, it's not like any other regular school night.
Yeah, I don't think she was taking them to Good Time Charlie's all the time. She's probably working most nights, to be honest. And then I think sometimes she would go out after work. But yeah, I'm sure this was just a special occasion and the kids were excited. We know they were excited about their Aunt Kathy being there. So I'm sure they were excited to spend time with her. They left Good Time Charlie's around 10 p.m., giving a bartender Margaret knew a ride to another location. From there, Margaret and Kathy dropped Scott and Amy off at home. Margaret pulled into the driveway and the kids hopped out. Kathy called to Scott, reminding him to lock the door, but he just laughed because the door didn't lock. And I will say, many people in this area didn't lock their doors before this case. And not that those people had locks that were broken, but they just felt safe in their community. The kids disappeared into the cabin and Margaret watched the lights flick on before driving away. Scott and Amy routinely spent time home alone, so this night was not all that different from other nights for them. They were pretty close with one of their neighbors, the Luptons, spending quite a bit of time at each other's houses. The Luptons had 5 kids, and there was a little path they could take to get to each other's houses. The kids went back and forth between the homes all the time. So that night, Scott and Amy went over to their home. Nancy, one of the homeowners and the children's mother, remembered Scott and Amy stopping by. She said they were in especially high spirits, clearly excited about their aunt moving in with them. Scott and Amy spent some time playing with Nancy's kids, but as it got later and the kids got rowdier, she decided it was time to send them home around 11 p.m. So they weren't there for very long.
That's a pretty late school night.
Yeah, I figure that's partially why she sent them home. Even if they were being loud on a weekend, maybe she would have sent them home too, but I'm sure she had that in mind as well. And it is believed that Scott and Amy returned home after leaving the Luptons.
I'm sure you're about to tell me, but I'm assuming Margaret and Kathy were out at just another bar.
Yeah, they were out on the town at a bar. There's some conflicting information on which bar. Some sources say they just went back to Good Time Charlie's, while other sources say they went to a place called Larry's Club and then Rainbow Bar. They may have popped around to different places, done some bar hopping that night. It's not entirely clear, but we know they were out drinking. There's also mention of Margaret wanting to visit one of her friends who worked at a local hotel, but she never found this friend. Margaret and Kathy called it a night around 2 a.m. and arrived home shortly thereafter. And this is pretty late. Some people find this troubling, and Margaret, like I said, would stay out and leave the kids home alone sometimes. But I don't know if 2 a.m. was a typical time for her to get back home, or if they stayed out particularly late because it was the first night her sister was in town, like we talked about before. Margaret remembered that when they pulled up to the cabin, all the lights were out, which struck her as odd because the kids were both scared of the dark. So even if they were asleep, they would leave a light on in the house. And I may be a fully grown adult, but I'd probably be a little scared too because their cabin was so isolated. I know I mentioned the neighbor's house they visited, but it's not like they could see each other's homes because there were a lot of trees between the properties. And that property was between 100 and 200 yards away from the Fandel property. So I can definitely understand why the kids would leave a light or multiple lights on. So yeah, Margaret thought it was strange that every light was off. When Margaret and Kathy went inside, they did not see the kids, and they observed a pot of water on the stove that was described as still warm. But I couldn't find if the burner was on. I would presume it was because there was a box of uncooked macaroni next to the stove, as well as an open but unused can of tomato sauce. This was a meal Scott routinely prepared, so it would appear that he started to warm up a pot of water and was possibly interrupted. And the reason I point out the burner is because if it were still on, that would definitely point to an interruption. But if the burner were off, you could say maybe he just changed his mind and decided he didn't want macaroni anymore. If he were interrupted, I don't know if he would have had time to turn the burner off. Margaret didn't think too much of this at that moment, and there seems to be a lot of debate about whether Margaret checked on the kids, but I found a couple of sources that indicated Margaret, Scott, and Amy slept in the same bed. So if that's accurate, she wouldn't have had to go out of her way to check on them and know the kids were not in their cabin. Their home had two bedrooms, and I'm not sure what the other one was used for, if anything in particular. To the best of my knowledge, she was aware that Scott and Amy weren't home and assumed they were at the neighbor's house, which was a fairly common arrangement when she was out late. She thought they were sleeping there.
Yeah, maybe it was because she was out drinking and was maybe a little buzzed or even a little drunk, but she probably didn't pay any mind to the pot of water and the macaroni and the other ingredients sitting out on the counter because she was in that state of mind. And of course, the kids being gone, she likely assumed they were just sleeping at the neighbor's house.
And she did. Yeah, I don't think the macaroni and the warm pot of water and the tomatoes, like that does not go with the kids being gone and just sleeping at the neighbor's. Like that seems a little off, right? So I think you're right that the alcohol probably played a factor here. And maybe if she had been completely sober, she would have been a little more skeptical of the situation. The following morning, Margaret did not see Scott or Amy. So she presumed they went straight to school from the neighbor's house. Again, she assumed that's where they were.
Would this be like a common situation for them, like especially on a school night? Like they would just sleep somewhere else and go straight to school and they wouldn't see their mom that morning?
Yes. From what I could find, this is something they had done many times in the past. I couldn't tell you with what frequency. I don't know that it was something they did every week, but this is something they had done in the past. Yeah, this would not have been like a first time situation. But I don't think that Margaret liked that the kids didn't come home before going to school. So she went to work as usual around 8:30 a.m. And while she was there, she called Amy's school to leave a message. She wanted Amy to know she was in trouble for not coming home before heading to school. So I think in prior instances where they had stayed the night at the Luptons and then went to school the next day, they would typically come home first. So I guess that was one aspect of this situation that deviated from what they typically did. The person from Amy's school that she spoke with informed her that Amy hadn't shown up that day. The timeline here is a little blurry, but it's either that Margaret called Kathy, who had slept in until noon, and then learned that the neighbor kids came over to the house after school to see if Scott and Amy could play. And they informed Kathy that Scott and Amy had not spent the night before, or Kathy called and let Margaret know this. Margaret requested to leave work, but her boss would not let her go until after the lunch rush.
I definitely would have just left anyway.
I know. This is a dire situation. She doesn't know where her kids are, but even though she didn't leave, she then called her ex-husband and the kid's father, Roger. She couldn't reach him right away, but got a hold of a family member of his who indicated he was in Arizona. And then Margaret confirmed over the phone with the neighbor, Nancy, that the kids had been over at her house the night before, but they did not stay there overnight. And that's when everything Margaret had assumed completely fell apart. After lunch, Margaret sped home in search of Scott and Amy. She made more calls, looked around the property. Family, friends, and neighbors came to the cabin to help as well, but they all found nothing. It was literally as though the kids had vanished into thin air. So Margaret reported Scott and Amy as missing to the Alaska State Troopers shortly after 5 p.m. There was some initial hesitation from law enforcement. They thought maybe Scott and Amy had just run away, but that was dispelled pretty quickly. Scott's bike was still there, and he almost always rode that bike when he left home. And his coat was inside too, and it was a chilly night when they were last seen. It was believed that Amy was wearing the vest she had been wearing that day because it was not inside the home. In fact, none of the clothes they had been wearing that day were inside the cabin. So Amy had a vest on, but not a coat. Plus, the kids always stayed in touch with their mom. They hadn't left like this before. They would even call Margaret so much at work that she feared she could lose her job. There was really no information to support that the kids just decided to up and leave. Within a day after they were reported missing, the Alaska State Troopers had launched an intensive ground search. Troopers, along with volunteers and search dogs, combed the woods surrounding the Fandahl property, but found no trace of Scott or Amy. Some shell casings were found around the property, but that was not unusual considering the location here and in the wilderness. There were no bullet holes in the cabin or blood anywhere to indicate that anyone had been shot, and no one remembered hearing shots fired that night. So these shell casings aren't really considered a clue in this case. Just a few days after the kids were last seen, their father, Roger, arrived in Alaska from Arizona. Roger, Margaret, many other family members and members of the community were interviewed by law enforcement. Margaret was emotionally distraught. She was unable to return to work because of the emotional distress, but she also wanted to stay home to remain by the phone in case anyone called with important information. Margaret didn't have any answers, but a few witnesses provided some helpful information to law enforcement early on in the investigation. One local resident recalled seeing the Fandahl cabin all lit up around 11:45 p.m., which, if correct, helps with the timeline. But their cabin was barely visible from the road, so it did surprise me that someone just passing by would notice this and clock what time it was. I'm not saying that's suspicious, but we have to take it with the understanding that their memory might be a little bit off. However, if it wasn't off, we know something happened relatively late within a short window because Margaret and Kathy arrived home about 2 hours after that and all the lights were out. This narrows the window in which something happened to Scott and Amy. Although I'm not sure if an abductor would turn all the lights off, but maybe if they entered the home and feared that someone could see something happening from outside, if the blinds were open, maybe they would turn all of the lights off as soon as they got in there. A different local resident reported seeing a black sedan speeding away from the road in front of the Fandahl home on the night the children disappeared. Suspecting a burglary, the resident followed the vehicle and watched it pull into a nearby driveway and shut off its headlights. The witness continued down the road briefly, then turned around, I think still thinking about what they had just witnessed. They then saw the sedan pull out of this other driveway and speed off again. But we don't know where the car went from there. A black Chevy sedan with a loud muffler was also reportedly seen at Margaret's home shortly before the kids disappeared. We will come back to this car here in a moment because more information came out later. But first, there are just a couple of other vehicles of interest that popped up. According to early reports, the Alaska State Troopers shared that they were searching for an older model van that stopped near the Fandel home about a week before Scott and Amy disappeared. There were three men in this van, and Scott allegedly spoke with these people. Law enforcement said they had no reason to be suspicious of them, but of course wanted to talk to them anyway. Then a couple who lived in Soldotna, which I think I already said this, but Soldotna and Sterling are neighboring communities, reported that just before Scott and Amy disappeared, their children were approached by a strange man driving a blue pickup truck. He passed by them three times, each time waving and smiling, which made the kids, ages 9 to 11, uneasy as they didn't recognize him. As far as I could find, this was a dead end, but it's possible they identified the driver of this truck and did not find a connection between him and Scott and Amy's disappearance. 4 months after their disappearance, the Alaska State Troopers revealed they had finally identified the driver and passenger of the black Chevy sedan seen at Margaret's cabin shortly before Scott and Amy vanished.
Do we know if this black sedan is the same black sedan that was seen speeding off from Margaret's cabin the night of the disappearance?
Good question. We don't know. We're about to get into who was associated with this vehicle when it was actually at the residence days before the kids disappeared. And they deny that they were in that area on the night in question. So according to them, that was a different car. So we'd have to believe that there was a different black sedan in that area that night that may or may not have been involved in their disappearance. But to take a step back here, the driver was identified as 25-year-old Richard Twigg, and the passenger was believed to be a man named Robert Mangold. You know what was so jarring to me? The state troopers put this information out there that they were looking for these two men, and they provided details about Richard and Robert, including their social security numbers. It was jarring because by today's standards, that seems wild, but in the 70s, people didn't treat social security numbers the same type of sensitivity you would expect today. And I have seen this in a couple of other older cases we've covered. Anyway, they wanted to find Richard and Robert to question them. Interestingly, these men were also linked to a van that matched the description of the one I mentioned earlier, the one that had stopped at the Fandel home shortly before the kids disappeared with people in the vehicle who allegedly spoke with Scott. So it seemed that Margaret was the one who linked the black sedan to Richard and Robert. Margaret shared with the Alaska State Troopers that she met one of these men shortly before the kids disappeared at a bar in Sterling. She didn't know much about him besides that he was a traveling carnival worker, but I believe she initially met Richard and then Robert, but she only knew Richard by a nickname. So that's what made this so hard for the investigators to track down these men. After meeting at the bar, he rode to Margaret's cabin with her. And it's unclear what transpired that day, but that was how he learned where Margaret lived. So he, along with two others, including Robert and some unknown man, went to Margaret's home while she was at work one day, just before the kids vanished. They arrived in a van, and Amy called Margaret at work to let her know that there were three men at the house wanting to use their shower. When Margaret got home, the men were lounging in the living room, and despite Margaret's repeated requests, they refused to leave. She recalled that one of them, believed to be Robert Mangold, was unusually quiet, but appeared particularly interested in Scott. They spent the night talking about UFOs, religion, and ancient civilizations with Scott. The three men eventually left in the van they arrived in. So tying this back to the sedan, one of the men owned a black Chevy sedan, but it had broken down. So they had been hitching rides from the van and the man, or what I meant to say was the man and the van, and therefore were associated with both vehicles of interest.
So when were they at the house in relation to the day they disappeared? You said this was like a few days before?
Yeah, I don't have the exact date, but it was in the week before the kids disappeared.
Was the black sedan getting fixed? Because you mentioned that it was broken down and that's why they were catching rides with the man in the van. But then we get the information that there was a black sedan seen speeding off from Margaret's cabin that night. So I'm wondering if it was actively getting fixed. You know, it was ready to drive the night of the disappearance.
I know it was fixed and back up and running the day after the kids disappeared. Couldn't tell you with 100% certainty if it was working on the night of their disappearance, but I feel like there's a pretty good chance if it was up and running the next day. So, and I know that because of something I'm about to tell you. So the Alaska State Troopers tracked Robert and Richard down. They had both left Alaska long ago. They found one of the men in Maryland and the other in Pennsylvania. Richard and Robert both denied any involvement in Scott and Amy's disappearance. One of the men admitted he had once driven down Margaret's driveway intending to visit her, but changed his mind and left. He claimed this happened the night after the children disappeared, which is interesting because you would think he would have seen a big commotion, a big scene at Margaret's cabin that night, because that was shortly after she reported them as missing. And he didn't mention that. However, when later asked if he could have been mistaken about the timing, he said he could have been. And this is how I know the black sedan was fixed by then, because he claimed to be driving that very sedan when he went down Margaret's driveway the night after the kids disappeared. Pretty odd to drive out to her cabin only to turn around and leave without even knocking on her door. It could also be an attempt to explain why his car, the black Chevy sedan, may have been seen in the area, especially since he could have been mistaken about which night it was exactly. We do know they were still in Alaska when Scott and Amy disappeared, and they had worked the state fair the day before the kids vanished. But we don't know if they were in Sterling specifically that night. Law enforcement tracked down the Chevy and had it examined for hair, fingerprints, and clothing fibers at an FBI laboratory to no avail. They found no evidence to link Scott or Amy to the Chevy sedan. I wondered, though, if they were involved, if they could have been in that van they were connected to. But then again, like you pointed out, the witness who saw the suspicious vehicle leaving Margaret's driveway on the night in question saw a black sedan, not a van. Ultimately, the investigators found nothing concrete to link any of these men to the case.
I mean, these guys definitely are suspicious. Makes you wonder what exactly their intentions were. And if they were, you'd think if they had bad intentions, then that day they showed up to the house and Margaret got home and they were inside the house, they could have done whatever they were planning to do that day.
I know. I thought about that as well. Like, they would have had a perfect opportunity to do it then. But if you look at it a little bit differently, like if just one of the men were involved, such as Richard, since he was the driver of the black sedan, maybe he wouldn't have done something then, because Robert and the other guy wouldn't have been in on it with him. So I think when you lump them in together, yeah, it does seem a little weird. Like, why didn't they just do it then, if they were all in on it? But I don't know, if just one of them had something to do with it, that would make sense. And that could have been where he or how he learned that Margaret isn't home all the time. And maybe he would have noticed that the door didn't lock, right? And could have picked up on these details. So I think they are suspicious. I especially think the whole, Yeah, I was. I drove my car in the area, drove it down Margaret's driveway, and then turned around one night. That feels like he's trying to put his car there on a different night and to cast doubt on someone who saw this black sedan in the area. And maybe that person was wrong. For all we know, that person could be wrong on which night they saw what they saw. So there are a lot of factors here. I don't know quite what to make of these guys, but I do think they're suspicious. The investigators viewed the case largely as an abduction. They thought someone who was likely familiar with the kids to some degree went to their home and lured them out. It makes sense that the person or people were familiar with the Fandel family for a couple of reasons. They lived in a very rural area. The odds of a stranger who was out with the intent to kidnap children just stumbling upon a cabin tucked in the woods with two kids who just happened to be alone in a home with a door that didn't lock are rather low. You might think that maybe they wanted to burglarize a home and they were surprised to find two kids inside and decided to kidnap them. But the kids were scared of the dark, so the cabin was likely entirely lit up, signaling to a wrongdoer that someone was home. We'd also have to believe that they then made the sudden decision to kidnap two children instead of being spooked and leaving. Additionally, Margaret believed the abductor would have had to say something to make the kids concerned or excited enough to be willing to leave, such as that Margaret had been in a car accident or their father wanted to see them. The idea of a luring mechanism was raised because of the lack of a struggle in the home. Everything seemed to be in place. All that stood out was the pot of water on the stove and the uncooked macaroni. But I suppose since the cabin's door didn't lock, someone could have entered the home and forcefully abducted them without leaving too much evidence, especially if they had a weapon to threaten the kids with. The investigators did not believe that this was a kidnap for ransom situation because no one had attempted to collect ransom after Scott and Amy disappeared. And if you think about it, if the abductor knew Margaret, they probably knew that money was tight and they would not be the best target for something like that. Law enforcement investigated Scott and Amy's family, including Margaret and Roger. Margaret had the means and opportunity to do something to her children, but did she have the motive? There are quite a few people out there who find Margaret's actions the night the kids disappeared as neglectful at best. Some even think she could have been behind what happened to them. Could this have been an accident that was covered up by Margaret? I don't know what sort of accident could have occurred that involved both children. However, this is a possibility that remains, which wouldn't have involved direct action. But no matter how you feel about Margaret's decision that night to stay out and drink while the kids were home alone, and maybe you think she even concocted the story about the macaroni and the pot of water, and she called the school the next day asking about Amy to set up the story, there was no evidence that a crime took place inside the cabin. And if we were to believe that Margaret harmed her children, Kathy gets lumped into that as well, because it seems unlikely that something could have happened under Kathy's nose in that tiny cabin. So in that theory, it's more likely that she was complicit than not. It wouldn't be the first time someone helped their sibling with something like this, and the timing feels coincidental. But if we believe that they were drunk when they came home, then I'd find it hard to believe that they murdered Scott and Amy and then covered it up in their drunken state in a way that left no evidence. And there is no evidence that we are aware of that makes Margaret a suspect.
I'm curious what Kathy's perspective on all of this is. I mean, she arrived that night and she was with Margaret the whole time. I haven't heard what she was doing that day. You know, what happened when Margaret reported them missing? Did she help with the search? Just everything.
As far as that day goes, she slept in until noon and then I think she was just at home for the rest of the day and then helping Margaret once they put together that the kids were missing. But I am also very curious about Kathy's perspective on what may have happened, like at that time, what she was thinking. I couldn't find any public statements from her, which I thought was interesting just because she was one of the last people to see the kids and it was the first night she was in Alaska. I mean, how crazy is that? The first night she was there, Scott and Amy disappeared, never to be seen again. But Margaret is not considered suspect or person of interest in Scott and Amy's disappearance, and neither is Kathy. On the other hand, Margaret and other family members expressed suspicions about Roger. One article described Roger as radiating aggression and that he enjoyed the effect that had on others. Roger admitted he had violent tendencies and he definitely sounded rough around the edges. But you're probably wondering if Roger even had the means or motive to abduct his children, considering he lived in Arizona. Roger felt he was viewed as a suspect from the outset, and the investigators scrutinized him relentlessly despite having confirmed that he was in Arizona when the kids vanished. They proposed the possibility that he could have gotten someone else to take the kids away for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, in his defense, he did voluntarily leave the kids, you know, whenever that was, when he left for Arizona eight, nine months ago.
Right. I think there would be a better case for him wanting to abduct his own children or hire someone to abduct his own children if Margaret like took them away from him, but that didn't happen. Roger felt frustrated with the investigation. He felt they wasted too much time on him, but he also acknowledged that he instigated some of that because he was kind of a wild card. He was quite abrasive, and that made them feel like they had to keep an eye on Roger. Roger also expressed frustration with Margaret because she was not home when Scott and Amy were presumably abducted. But he wasn't there either. He left Margaret as a single parent, and ultimately that led him to carry feelings of guilt. Interestingly, 5 years ago, Margaret's brother, Terry, was interviewed by a podcast called Crime Over Coffee, and he openly expressed that he believes Roger and or his family were involved in Scott and Amy's disappearance, and that Amy is possibly still alive. Terry shared in the interview that shortly after the kids vanished, Roger entered Margaret's cabin, waved a gun around, pulled Margaret's hair, and said, "They're after me." We don't know who they are. Recall that when Roger moved to Arizona, he moved with a girlfriend. Well, they eventually broke up, and she later approached Roger's uncle, who he had problems with, saying that she would tell him what happened to Scott and Amy in exchange for $5,000. But he did not accept the offer, probably because it sounds like a load of BS, in my opinion. In 1982, law enforcement dug up Roger's uncle's yard after receiving a tip that the kids were buried there. Allegedly, this tip came from Roger, but they found nothing. Roger was a part of the Plumbers and Steamfitters Union and was not necessarily well-liked. He caused strikes within the union, so Terry brought up the theory that someone from the union abducted Scott and Amy in retaliation for Roger's actions. Terry also suggested that Roger may have had a large debt to drug dealers. Bottom line, there's no shortage of speculation around Roger. There's even a theory that one of Roger's family members who owned an airplane flew the children out of the state. And the investigators were pulled in countless directions. And typically, their investigation into one Fandel family member was at another family member's request. There were a lot of issues within the Fandel family. But as was the case with Margaret, there's no known definitive evidence to link Roger to the disappearance of Scott and Amy. And like I said, they confirmed he was in Arizona that night. So if he did have a hand in this, it was through someone else.
Yeah, Roger definitely raises a lot of red flags. I'd be curious to know if the police questioned any of his good friends, not even good friends, just anyone he was associated in Alaska still, what they knew.
No one had anything solid against Roger. They spoke with a lot of people, family and friends of Roger's. And at the end of the day, no one could pin this on him directly. There are theories left and right about him, like I mentioned. And my head started to spin reading about and hearing about all the different theories that could have been related to Roger. I think he was mixed up in some stuff. He was not well-liked necessarily. So maybe it's easier with someone like him to come up with these kind of theories. But there's just nothing that I'm aware of that was concrete against him. And law enforcement today, I don't think would consider him a suspect or probably even a person of interest. So we've talked about potential family involvement as well as Richard and Robert, who, as far as I can tell, have not been conclusively ruled out. And despite what I just said about Roger, I don't know that he's been conclusively ruled out. I don't know that anyone has, considering they haven't found who did this. And it didn't sound like it was a simple task to rule people out. But could there have been someone else behind this? There are theories that someone at Good Time Charlie's overheard Margaret talking about dropping the kids off at home, or possibly even followed Margaret, Kathy, and the kids back to the cabin in their car. From there, they may have clocked where they lived and then returned when they saw the kids alone inside. Although Margaret and Kathy did not report any suspicious people lingering around them that night. I suppose someone in Margaret's life, she knew a lot of people, may have known that she left the kids home alone and took advantage of that. What drives someone to abduct two children? Stranger abductions of children are extremely rare, but especially two children. Now, whether they knew the kids or not could play a role in why they would abduct Scott and Amy, but it's disturbing no matter how you look at it. Even if we go back to Richard and or Robert, what would they have to gain by kidnapping these children? It's kind of the same thought as a stranger abducting them, and it's not good. Margaret and Roger both struggled after losing their kids in this way. Margaret went down a self-destructive path for several years. She felt she had no reason to live. They both moved away from Alaska within a couple of years of the kids' disappearance. Margaret moved back to her home state of Illinois, like she once hoped to do. And Roger moved to California and then on to various other states. Margaret remarried 6 to 7 years after the kids disappeared, and she credited her husband with saving her life. She stopped drinking and spent more time on her passions, such as upholstery work and refinishing antiques. Margaret also found purpose through fostering children, and they were even approved to adopt one of the children they fostered. Normally, with a disappearance, we would provide the physical descriptions of the victims, but Scott and Amy were so young. So I'd rather recommend that you view the age-progressed images of them that are available, which we will share on our Instagram at Key to the Case Podcast, but you can also find them with a quick Google search. This case was depressing to research, as they all are, but I kept thinking about the fear the kids may have felt and how Scott probably protected his sister until the very end. And then you think about the person who did this and how they got away with it, and the emotion kind of turns from sadness to anger. So if you have information related to the disappearance of Scott and Amy Fandell, please contact the Alaska State Troopers at 907-262-4453. Thank you all so much for tuning in this week. That is all for now, but we will be back in 2 weeks with a new case. Bye.
Bye.